there anyone here that is new to the Village Zenda? Welcome. And welcome to everyone tonight. I don't know if you know, but we're a meditation center here, and we have meditation three times a day during the week. And, on Sundays in the morning, we have a Roshi and many wonderful teachers here, and lots of events which are posted on the bulletin board and on our website. Next Thursday, we have another visitor, a Zen speaker, Norman Fisher, who's not only a Zen master, but also a well-known poet. And he'll be speaking in the same time frame next week. I'm Howard. I'm the executive director here. I'm a student at the Zendo. So I guess you all know why you're here, but I'll read this anyway. Robert Kaku Gun is a Hoshi in our tradition. I think that's kind of like being a resident in a hospital after you've done your medical school. So on the teacher track here, and he is a teacher here and gives interview, but he's also a Christian minister. He's a Buddhist priest. He's a classical pianist, and probably many other things that I don't know, and an author of this book. A few years ago, I met Henry Finch, a famous Wittgenstein scholar, and we were talking about my life in yoga and Zen and different forms of Buddhism, and he said, you must tell your story. It's important. We're the first generation of Americans. Of course, Thoreau and Emerson read the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita, but our generation is the first that actually took serious practice. And as you know, many people went to Japan, went to India, and studied seriously in these traditions. And I didn't write that autobiography, but Kaku has written a memoir, which you're here to hear about. And I think that's, I'll leave you with that.
Okay.
So please welcome Robert Kaku Gun.
So thank you. I'm very pleased and honored to be here tonight. This is, as you might imagine, a very special occasion for me. You're the first group that I have talked to about my book that was fairly recently published, my memoir, One Bright Pearl. And let me say that without you, without the Sangha, I certainly would not be here, and neither would the book. And even though the memoir ends before I became a member of this Sangha, nevertheless, my being in this Sangha is what helped bring the book forth. So my deep gratitude to Roshi, with whom I sat my first session at another place and time, and all of you, when I came to the Village Zendo, Roshi said, "I hope you will let us love you." And it took a while, because I walked into here not trusting much of anybody, and not trusting Zen institutions per se, but you've won my heart, and I am so grateful to be a member of this Sangha, and especially pleased to be here tonight. So I hope that in sharing my story, your stories will be pulled forth, and you will feel free to share your stories as well as whatever your response is to mine. So I'm going to begin with one of the stories from the first volume, and I will end with a story from the second volume. And the two are related in this way. First of all, let me say that this memoir has been long in the making. I published my first book, Journeys into Emptiness, in 2000, and immediately set to work on the second book, which is what you see before you. But I was intent on writing the quintessential thing that needed to be said about the interconnection between Christianity and Zen Buddhism and depth psychology. After about 5 years of trying to do that, my editor and coach said, "You know, Bob, I think it wants to be a memoir." So it only took another 10 years to, you know, come up with this. So my first story is about my Christian life. And on the morning of September 13th, 1953, a month before my 10th birthday, in the First Methodist Church in Mounds, Illinois, where Pawpaw used to preach and my parents were married, I had what is commonly referred to in Methodist circles as a conversion experience. It was at the end of a week-long revival, which I had attended every night. That Sunday morning, as the service ended with a call for those who wanted to accept Jesus into their hearts to come down to the altar, I struggled to sing as a lump in my throat got bigger and bigger. The preacher called out the invitation to come down and give our lives to Christ. "Almost persuaded," we sang. "Now to believe, almost persuaded, Christ to receive. Seems now some soul to say, 'Go, sinner, go thy way, some more convenient day, on thee I'll call.'" Guilt and shame overwhelmed me. I was being called to leave my sin behind, to let go and come to Jesus. "Come home," we sang on. "Come home, ye who are weary, come home." People kept singing, though I could not. My voice choked as I struggled against the impulse to surrender to the call. Finally, as they sang, "Just as I am without one plea," I could hold back no longer. I ran down sobbing, feeling the release of letting go, the release of giving in and falling into the love of Jesus. I ran down to kneel at the altar rail where others, all grown-ups but me, were also kneeling and crying and praying and giving their hearts to Jesus. The preacher bent over and put his hand on my shoulder, welcoming me with compassion and understanding. I felt I was at the very throne of God, welcomed, unworthy sinner though I was, into the fullness of his mercy. I was home. For me, the experience was utterly profound, transforming, and real. At that moment, I knew who I was because I knew who God was. Jesus was calling me to himself and to God, calling me home. Who I was this wretched sinner, hopelessly lost except for that call to come home, where I was accepted, received, and welcomed with open arms, just as I am. The boy who had never stayed in one house for more than a year found his unconditional home with God, whom he would never have to leave again, who promised never to leave him. So fast forward, to about 40 some odd years later. 2 weeks after I returned from Maine, I received a postcard in the mail sent to me by Zen Mountain Monastery in Mount Tremper, New York. I had never heard that there was a monastery anywhere in the U.S., a Zen monastery. Coincidentally, I had recently recovered a copy of Zen Mind Beginner's Mind by Shunryu Suzuki from my college days. The postcard itself reminded me of the first therapist I ever saw at the American Foundation for Religion and Mental Health, who had told me about the koan of the goose in a bottle. There's a goose in a bottle. How does the goose get out without breaking the bottle? I called and made a reservation for their introduction to Zen the last weekend in August. 3 hours northwest of New York City, the Adirondack bus turned off of the New York Thruway onto a small two-lane road that went through Woodstock and Bearsville, through tall pines, maples, and white birches on either side, forming a natural welcome line into a world vastly different from the city. The bus dropped me off at the Three Corners intersection of Mount Tremper. The smell of the trees and the sound of the stream flowing over the rocks was immediately enchanting. I crossed the Beaverkill River over a wooden bridge and took the gravel road on the right, where a sign said, Zen Mountain Monastery, quiet please, out of respect for those in retreat. The large wood and stone building with a dark red roof and gables looked like it had come from a 15th century European village. The gravel road led to a series of flat stones to the large heavy wooden door with a carved squirrel for its handle. The weight of the door as I opened it gave seriousness of purpose to my entrance. A large scroll of an old bearded and bug-eyed man looking at me fiercely with lines of Japanese calligraphy at his side hung over the stairway that led down into the office. Leaded glass windows let light into the small room where a short, bald-headed Asian woman with a smiling face greeted me. Hi, I'm Jimon, she said, and gave me papers to fill out, instructions for the weekend and the schedule. Beautiful place here, I said. Yes, it was built by the Jesuits and then sold to the Lutherans, now us. Hasn't changed much. She came out from the desk. I'll show you to your room. We climbed back up the stairs, then walked along the back of what she called the Zendo, a large hall filled with black cushions lined in rows perpendicular to the altar. Tall casement windows lined both sides of the room, filling it with light. A wooden statue of the Buddha was at the center. She turned and bowed as we passed. I followed suit. She led me up another flight of stairs to a dormitory-style room filled with bunk beds. Pick a bed. Supper's at 5:15. Feel free to wander around the grounds or have coffee, which is always downstairs in the dining hall. I set my bags at the foot of one of the beds and decided to wander around the place. Out the back door of the dining hall, concrete steps curved around to make a full semicircle facing the monastery. I turned at the top to look behind me and saw, affixed to the back wall of the monastery, a huge statue of Christ on the cross. It surprised me, but recalling Jimon's comment that the place was originally Jesuit, then Lutheran, it made sense. Except, why had the abbot left it there? Beyond the semicircle, a lawn spread out to a wooded area and a parking lot, and to the left, the grass stretched up on a hill to another wooded area, and the far left, a small one-story white clapboard cottage. I meandered through the grass up the hill and into the woods. The woods, I thought to myself. I thought back to Bluford, Illinois, and how often I walked through the cornfield to the woods. To be among tall trees has always given me a warm, comfortable feeling ever since. Fallen branches, fallen leaves, the crack of stepping on sticks, light and shadows crisscrossing everywhere. A chipmunk skirted across the path. Birds were singing up in the trees. A large black crow flew from one tree to another with its caw, 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 reminding me of Maine and my childhood in Illinois. How I missed this. For all the pizzazz of the city, I missed grass and pine trees and wild animals. As I continued walking in the woods, I thought back to those years when my brother Bill would lie on the floor and I would play with him. to the years we tried to get him to walk in braces and the decision to place him in a state institution. I thought back to my struggle with my attraction to people of my own gender from the time I was 2 and how I lived with that conflict as a basso continuo in my life. How often I had thought of suicide as a way out. I then thought of my decision to marry and my management of my conflict through drinking, and then how sobriety became a decision to choose life on whatever terms were available. Lastly, I thought of my absolute gratitude for Allison and Laura, my daughters, for their still being alive, and yet the fact of their psychological precariousness tormented me. What kind of world is it that such cruelty of fate could hold sway even potentially? And what about the many people who don't recover? How can there be joy? How can love be trusted? And what is this precious, fleeting, tenuous thing called life? I found a large log and sat down. Why am I here? I asked myself. Because you have nowhere to go. Well, I thought I did. I thought I was going to get a PhD, get a teaching job, write books like Anne Ulanoff, maintain my private practice, have a nice family, have a nice life. And then you came out, got divorced, dropped out of doctoral studies. One daughter nearly killed herself, and the other one lost her mind, her very sharp, very smart mind. I broke into tears. What have I done? Nothing, absolutely nothing, is worth my daughters' lives, their mental health, their joy, my delight. I picked up a stick, fiddled with it. Maybe I should have killed myself, stayed in the marriage, remained respectable, kept drinking, and maybe died in a car accident. Yeah, right. And what kind of legacy would that have been for the kids? Besides, Allison's giving Bryn Mawr another try in the fall. Maybe she can pull out of it. But the spark is gone. More tears. It's the meds. Maybe she'll get better and not need the meds. Inside the monastery, I noticed a series of pictures lining a wall. They were black and white brush drawings with verses written in Chinese and translated into English. The ox herding pictures. They showed a young Asian man searching for an ox, which it said was actually a search for the self. At first, the self is mostly hidden, and one simply sees tracks in the weeds. As the full ox is revealed, the young man has to learn how to tame it and ride it. As he gains mastery, he is shown riding the ox, playing a flute in the marketplace, and finally, both the man and the ox disappear. I read each picture, and as I read, I felt deeply moved and started crying again. I didn't know why or how, but it seemed to me that the pictures were telling my own story and answered the question of why I was here, although I couldn't understand what it was saying. My tears slowed and I felt a deep calm penetrate my entire body, relaxing and breathing a huge sigh. It's about taking the backward step, Shugen said when we gathered after supper in the Zendo. In coming here, you have given yourself space and time to step back from your ordinary routine and ask yourself, who am I? Where am I going and why? These are fundamental life questions. Why is there so much suffering in the world is another one. Many people ask these questions, but don't really work with them to get an answer. We're not here to give you answers, but to offer you a way to work with the questions. I cried again. How did he know? I felt so incredibly understood by him, not personally, but as having been through a parallel experience. Shugen's words and everything about this place was speaking to me through every organ of my body. What I was seeing, smelling, touching, hearing, even tasting, it was so precisely what I needed. At the same time, some things bothered me. I was very distrustful of all the bowing. As a Protestant, the only place I ever knelt was during my days in the Methodist Church at the altar, during my conversion in childhood, and to receive communion. Bowing was considered a misguided Catholic practice. Jesus himself had said to bow to no one. It was a form of idolatry. I was especially turned off at the idea of bowing to an ordinary human being like a teacher. Dido impressed me as someone who didn't doubt that he deserved the bows. He didn't seem to have any doubts at all. He seemed arrogant to me. But I was there to learn, and when in Rome. Plus, I felt I was following Hoekendyk's advice that he'd given me at Union concerning preaching. Practice as if it's true and see what happens. Over the course of Saturday and Sunday, every time someone quoted Dogen, the 13th century founder of Soto Zen in Japan, I felt my heart leap and my eyes water. There was something penetrating and powerful in this man's writing that came through even in English translation. In his Dharma talk Sunday morning, Dido quoted a verse from Dogen's Ginjo Koan. To follow the Buddha way is to follow the self. To follow the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be confirmed by the 10,000 things. To follow the self, Dido continued, is Zazen. Za means to sit. Zen means to meditate. So Zazen means sitting Zen or sitting meditation. What we do in sitting meditation, we pay attention to what is. What is includes the entire universe. We pay attention to what we see. That's why we don't close our eyes entirely. We want to be awake, not go to sleep. We hear whatever sounds arise. We notice our thoughts and feelings, feelings of the body, feelings of emotions. We simply notice these things and let them go. Well, Dido went on. When we are able to forget the self, we've lost our separateness. There is no more separation between us and the whole catastrophe called life. The self of you becomes the self of the entire universe. The sounds of the rain, the wind, sirens, cars, people talking, dogs barking, it is all you and you are it. You are the self of all that is. And so he went on. So at the end of the weekend, Shugen came up to me at the monastery bookstore after we'd eaten. How was it for you? I smiled and pointed to the zafu and zabuton, the meditation cushions, and a black leather-bound copy of Dogen's Shobogenzo I was just paying for. I've already signed up for the next 3 weekends, I said. Sounds pretty serious, he said, smiling. Well, yes, of course. I gave him a big hug. Thanks for everything. I may not have all the answers, but I know where I need to be now. So. So that's how it started, and that's how I got here, basically. So I've asked a couple of people to bring up some other parts from the book, and Miyagetsu and Howard.
I decided to pull a couple of threads. These books were very moving for me, and they taught me a lot about myself. And this is why you should think about what you're going to say beforehand. To me, one of the strongest themes is what I would call the Zen teaching or the manifestation of the Zen teaching on honesty and intimacy in relationships, and that starts with that honesty and intimacy with oneself. So that's the first thread I'm going to pull, and I'm just going to read some short episodes which were kind of searing in their honesty. One of the recurring experiences is Kakko being bullied, and he goes at one point to an incident where he remembers his mother bullying him. When I was 6 years old in Blueford, my mother sent me to the hotel to get my dad and tell him to come home to dinner. It was probably half a mile on an oil cinder road from our house. I got to the door of the hotel and painted on the door were the words, "No minors allowed." I wondered why they didn't want miners in the hotel. My Uncle Joyce was a coal miner, and I didn't understand. I walked in, and it was smoky and noisy, but I saw my daddy sitting at the table with some other men playing cards. I saw the money on the table. I knew what that meant. Henry, isn't that your son? Someone at the table said. My daddy looked up from the cards in his hand and stared at me as I walked over to the table. Mother said to tell you to come home. We're having supper soon. My voice sounded weak to me, but then Daddy ruffled my hair and told me he'd be along soon and for me to go back home and tell her. I went back home as soon as I got through the door, I burst into tears and knelt down sobbing into the red velvet platform rocker. What's wrong? My mother asked. He was gambling, I said, and more tears poured out. And my mother reached down and patted me on the back. There, it will be all right, but I think you should tell him how you feel when he comes home. And so I did what my mother said I should, and I felt the worst kind of horrible, horrible, that I saw my daddy doing something that I had been told repeatedly in church in no uncertain terms was wrong, and horrible that I, at the age of 6, had to tell my daddy what I saw and thought, to be his accuser, to betray him when all I wanted to do was to love him. And later on, he's in a late night and scotch-infused conversation with some friends, one of whom is his lover. I feel funny saying him, but his lover, okay? As John and Jack and I worked on our scotches, I filled my pipe, lit it, and tried to forget about Gil. Gil was another young man there who he clearly had a strong attraction to. You know, I was just thinking, why is it that we can get so heated up talking about Vietnam and politics and economics? We haven't even got to religion yet. Like, what's our investment in the conversation? I think you said it a while ago. There are issues of life and death. They affect how we live, what our goals are, what our commitments are, John offered. Issues of life and death. I've never felt them so keenly as I have since turning 40, especially when I find myself thinking of death, Jack said. When you're younger, it doesn't seem to be so important. I've thought of it seriously all my life, I said. Yeah, but it doesn't hit you like it does at 40, Jack said. It's very real, of course, but when you turn 40, it carries a different valence, John insisted. As I listened to Jack and John, I realized I was getting annoyed. They were condescending to me because of my still being in my 20s, assuming I could not have felt any more on the issues of death than they did at my age. Maybe I was crazy to feel as strongly as I did, but still, had they watched 3 of their own dogs die before the age of 6? Had they seen the dead bodies of 3 great-grandparents and a grandfather in coffins in the parlor of their own home before they were 10 years old? Had they grown up with a brother whose legs never developed and couldn't walk, making them wonder what could happen to their own legs or hands? Had they compared penis sizes with their cousin 1 month before they were 13 and then seen him lying in a coffin the next month because of a sudden bout of polio? And then he has a conversation with his lover, John, on the phone. And having had this intimate relationship, John decides that what they should do is leap on a freighter and go to Iceland. I poured out another glass of Johnny Red, lit my pipe, and imagined being on a freighter with John, where everyone would see us as a couple. I could hear their taunts and jeers, faggots, queers, fairies, fruits, the two of us alone with a ship full of fishermen. I imagined being beaten up in our bunks while sleeping. They could throw us overboard and claim we fell and drowned before they could pick us up. Gone, you're being paranoid, I said as I puffed on my pipe, which doesn't mean that they're not out to get us, I countered to myself. Nothing made sense. I had just spent 5 days with this man, sharing his bed, his family, his idyllic life. Now suddenly I was frozen inside. Somehow all our time in his apartment, at Union, at restaurants in New York, and at the Country Inn in Massachusetts, and the house on Mount Desert, all of it seemed like an idyll, a mystical experience that took place out of the ordinary space and time. And then his suggestion of Iceland came crashing through the idyll, shattering it, leaving him and me exposed to public view, like the pictures of Bill Wertheim showed me in the sophomore year at Columbia of Jews in Buchenwald after they had shed all their clothes, standing naked in front of Nazi dogs and guns. Shame and fear filled me as I tried to argue my way out of those images. Nazis singled out homosexuals, not just Jews, I said. Yeah, but this isn't Nazi Germany. Then why did I get called all those names and get beat up in every new school I moved to in Illinois? So the other thing that meant a lot to me was the understanding that as we make choices in our life, there are going to be consequences, and that sometimes we intend to do good and we end up doing bad, sometimes vice versa, but most of the time we don't know what those consequences are, but we have to own them, look at them, and take responsibility for them. And the responsibility ranges from the where I think you get to in the end, a very clear-eyed view. But they can be from defensive, I didn't do that, I didn't mean that, Howard did it, I didn't, to the other form of ducking, which is depression. You know, I'm a terrible person, I always do bad things. So I picked a couple of passages that kind of reflected that for me, where Kako is exploring that. And one of them is during Jukai. By taking responsibility, we avoid blaming anyone in isolation for the chain that unites us all. And in affirming our interdependence, we avoid the hubris of thinking we alone are responsible for anything. Acknowledging our role in what happens leads naturally to the question, how then do you change anything? The question is asked sincerely, not as a rhetorical dismissal of this perspective. How do we make any difference in the world when the array of variables is in itself infinite? Could I have made myself not gay? No. Could I have more strongly repressed that aspect of myself? But that would have created other dynamics, as in fact did when I lived in the closet. It led to my alcoholism, among other things. Had I been able to accept myself in my wholeness, perhaps I never would have married. Or I would have married but told Susan what I was dealing with. In either case, all that followed from either choice would have carried with it its own different causes and effects. Different, but never entirely without some form of suffering for everyone concerned. Being gay is only one of the infinite forms of human life. Other issues have other kinds of suffering. Even my brother is not alone in the suffering he experienced from cerebral palsy. It is one kind, but it is only one kind of suffering, thus underscoring the first noble truth's generalization that life is suffering. Okay? And give up the floor to Howard.
I'm really an understudy reader. I was reminded, I heard Dido Laurie, who was referred to in Kako's reading, tell a story once that some students of his told me they hadn't heard, which was when Maizumi Hiroshi came to confer his blessing on the Zen Mountain Monastery, he saw this cross, and he said, "Oh, that's so wonderful that you have this because you're a Catholic." And Daido said, "I'm not a Catholic, I'm a Zen Buddhist." And Maizumi said, "You're a Catholic." I thought in his reading, I thought, you know, I mentioned that he probably did many things that I hadn't mentioned when I introduced him, and among them was being a professor and a singer. So, as I said, I'm sort of a stand-in, but I looked at this. I read the book, but I didn't bring it with me. But I looked at this at his website, and there's a passage from the book that relates to some things that he mentioned in his reading about his brother. Before I ever heard of Buddhism, I learned the reality of the first noble truth of the Buddha, that life is suffering, from my brother. Bill was born in 1948 when I was 5 years old. Premature by 5 months, he was brought home from the hospital through the front door in a bassinet by my father and mother. Mama, my father's mother, and her mother, Grandma Gamble, and I gathered around the tiny baby. Though they spoke baby words of welcome, I recall the feeling of the moment as tense, hesitant, with as much concern for my mother as for the baby. Perhaps the precariousness of his life lent an unusual seriousness to his arrival, an ambivalent alloy of joy and sadness. Bill had been put into an incubator as soon as he had been delivered. Shortly after that, he had developed pneumonia that cut off an adequate supply of blood and oxygen to his brain. My mother said he turned black as a stovepipe, and Dr. Elkins, the family doctor, gave up, saying there was nothing more to be done. My father, by some stroke of intuitive genius, gave my brother mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. As a result, Bill survived, but with part of his brain paralyzed by the period of oxygen deprivation, and so was diagnosed as having cerebral palsy. The impact was not fully known at first. I remember a vague sense of warning where I tried to play with him lying on the floor, that I should treat him with special care. With his hands, Bill could grasp things, but his movements were spastic. Though he was high in what we now call emotional intelligence, his functional thinking intelligence was very limited, and he never learned to read or write beyond his own name. When Bill was 2, doctors discovered his heart had a leaky valve, and he was taken to St. Louis, Missouri, 8 miles north, for open heart surgery. In 1950, this was a new procedure and considered very risky. 2 years later, the cerebral palsy having left his legs both undeveloped and contracted, he had surgery on his legs, a cutting of the knee ligaments that kept his legs contracted. While it may have relieved some of the contraction tendency, it did nothing to help him walk. His legs muscles never developed, and his toes tended to curl slightly under his foot, making it difficult for him to wear shoes. For 10 years after, following doctor's orders, we would put him in full waist-to-toe steel braces, painfully forcing his legs to extend and trying to get him to walk as we held him under the shoulders or held onto him as he held onto a double pipe railing my father had constructed. Skip a little. For years, I had been on discussions with my parents about his condition and what could be done. Everything we knew at the time had been tried. The release from braces, while easier on him and us, was also an acceptance of the loss of hope. So I knew the answer about where to go. It was nevertheless hard to deliver. I hesitated, then said softly, "No, it doesn't look like there's anything else we can do." He cried, I cried. Later, when I told my mother, she cried. I don't remember telling my father. My brother's face, beaming with full happiness and a delight in being with us, as well as his body, relatively helpless and dependent, are with me always, indelibly shaping my experience of everything. From taking care of him, I learned patience, and that personal pleasure was less important than another's need. From his own ability to adapt immediately to what was happening, I learned a certain flexibility, and how often things that throw us off schedule or create unexpected difficulties are no big deal. From him, I learned to be responsible for others beyond myself. After many years, his self-acceptance and ability to enjoy life remain a teaching for me, in taking what one is given and working with it, rather than falling into self-pity. So thank you.
Anyone want to say anything or comment? No.
That's my job. So while you're all thinking of something to say, I'm moved by the writing is so compelling that I just want to hear the whole story from beginning to end. Of course, I know parts, you know, I know that you have an MDiv and that you worked in the church for many years. You're also a psychotherapist. I have attended several concerts where you've performed classical piano, and we got a taste of your singing. And on the bus to Washington, you led the singing, and it felt very old-time Christian to me. It was great. You rocked us out. So you're a man of many talents, and of course, as in man. So I was very moved by all the readings, and thank you.
So I'm interested in the question of true identity. I thought of it throughout reading the book, which I read all in a gulp on a plane. Mm-hmm. It occurred to me when I was telling the story about Dido, there was Maizumi saying to Dido, "You're a Catholic." So it's interesting to me because I guess everyone here knows that we're in a community that is sort of founded on a principle of no self and of the changeability of everything, all the way down to the bottom, to no bottom. So I'm kind of interested, maybe you could talk a little bit about this question of the true identity, because it was such a big theme in the book, related largely to your sexual identity, but not only to that. Mm-hmm.
When people find out that I am a Christian pastor and a Zen Buddhist priest, they say, "How is that possible?" People think of that question because they think in terms of either or, and they think that one thing precludes another. So the question of true self, which I very much intentionally tried to wrestle with in the book and articulate how my struggle for the true self, you know, was manifested in various conflicts and problems. The true self is not a thing. You know, it's not one more thing to be a category that, oh, I'm this, and therefore I'm not that. So that's the, I think, you know, that's what we mean by no self, is that basically there's nothing permanent, there's nothing fixed or unchangeable about anybody's self or about anything. And so everything is about now, about this moment and what's happening. I'm very blown away by your reading and Mio Getsu's reading.
Who wrote that?
Who did that? Who did that? Yeah, I don't know, you know. Wow, where did that come from? I don't know. It's pretty powerful stuff. I like it, you know, but I don't remember writing it, you know. I mean, it just, things happen. And so one reason that I read from those two places, you know, first volume of my conversion experience and then later, you know, as I was introduced to Zen, is I was in both places, I was trying to convey the emotional experience of the conversion and the emotional experience of opening up, how Zen opened me up, Zen practice opened me up. And so it's Zen that our Zen practice that helps us open up to ourselves and to be more in touch with whatever we think, feel, imagine, how we are in any moment. And there's a sense in both instances of what I would call, you know, at this point, today, tonight, you know, an experience of energy, of livingness, of vitality. You know, everybody would have a different word for, but it's that pizzazz, you know, but it's a deep pizzazz. And that's life-changing stuff. And that's where our the different conflicts and the places that are opening up for us converge and happen. And I think that's of the essence. So Christian, Buddhist, you know, these things are just words and labels. And the question is always, you know, are we awake now? We're alive now to what is, whatever it is. And so I so appreciate both of you for what you pulled out, you know, that I probably would have not gone to because it's still hot stuff for me, you know? I mean, I can't talk about my brother without, you know, getting all teary. And so I don't know what I just said, but thank you both for your offerings.
You've alluded to some of your experience of going through this already. I'm wondering if, as you were working on writing this and reliving some of these very powerful experiences from the past, what I'm curious about is whether you found that the process of doing that and writing it was itself transformative in some way.
Oh,
and could you speak to that a little bit?
Absolutely. Because, I mean, to try to put words to the various experiences, you got to let yourself open up. You know, I had a great editor, Jacob Miller. Highly recommend him for anybody wanting to do some writing. And you know, I would hesitate. I would say, you know, I don't want to go there. And he said, you got to go there. You know, and that's the kind of editor you need, and that's the kind of friend you need to help you open up to the hard stuff, the painful stuff, and a lot of shame and a lot of guilt and a lot of oy vey, and, you know. So I don't know if that.
Did you find that some of these events took on a different meaning or a new meaning than perhaps you had thought they did before? Or was it really more just the emotional reliving of the experiences?
I think doing all of this did take me to a different place, to a deeper awareness and acceptance of my complexity and of, you know, the stuff that's been hard in my life, including, you know, ambitions and all of the, you know, struggles with that. So it's yeah, it was... I grew, I would say, yeah.
Thank you all both so much, both of you. Mm. for putting this together, and Ryogetsu for pulling out those very heart-rendering sections. Thank you.
Oh, I was too nervous to say is that it is a very blessed journey to share that intimacy with you through those books. It's astounding and a real gift.
Thank you for saying that. It reminds me of a comment I've made to someone fairly recently who had read the book and said, oh, you've had such a hard life. And my comment was, oh, well, you know what? Everybody does, except not everybody knows that they did, you know, or tries to put it into words. And so, yeah, it's not that my life is extraordinary, but yeah, I'm just talking about stuff that people don't usually talk about.
Yeah. You mentioned that when most people find out that you're a Buddhist Zen practitioner and a minister, that they're surprised, because how do you work the difference between the two, and you know, how do you resolve that, you know? So the question to me is, how does one give you an appreciation for the other? How does that change your outlook, or what effect did that have for you, being able to come to that place where you can be both at the same time?
So at the point where, actually it's right around that section that I read about, you know, my first introduction to Zen, as I opened up to Zen and Zen opened me up, I experienced being touched in the same place inside that I had been touched in the conversion experience in Christianity. And so there was a sense in which I'm home again. It's the same place in me that is touched and being made alive. And that which triggers that has to in some way be the same, although, you know, different words and languages and so forth are used for it. So I experience the core stuff as the same, and everything else is about the words we use to describe it. That's what I'm, how I would put it.
Yeah, and I just imagine that it must have given you such a huge sense of relief and freedom, because if you have to choose between one and the other, that kind of puts you in a box, because then you have to wrestle between the two, and if you can combine them without one being conflict.
Well, you know, I had a very good teacher, and she told me, just think not to. That was the best advice anybody ever gave on the subject of Buddhist-Christian dialogue.
Because we have to move, and I do want you to have time to buy books. And, there is a third volume coming out next year, so we can do this again.